by the city council, hopefully they may have reviewed those numbers more. And but yeah, so well, I want to thank you for calling, and it's good to get, you know, your perspective. And I think we had got a good range of callers looking at this issue, and it's a really important issue for Portlanders, I think. And it's great to hear folks engaging in it, and maybe more people will engage in the process as it proceeds and review the, as you mentioned, review this change and see if it actually works, to get some data on it. And but certainly
following it up on the back end is going to be just as critical as passing it on the front end. Well, hey, have a wonderful day.
You too. Okay. Well, this is we're at the end of the show now. I think this is Jacqueline Keeler hosting for Wednesday Talk Radio, and we've been discussing different policies the city is trying out, these waivers of fees for infrastructure to developers, and whether or not that is a good policy or not to increase the affordability of housing. So thank you so much.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. That's Drinking from Puddles, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week.
I'm appalled at the way that the people have just been dismissed with their concerns. Whatever I can do, whatever resources I have, whether it's support, whether it's documents, whatever it is, I'm going to try to help them, because those are my brothers and sisters.
I'm Stephanie Schubert of Pacifica Network. Today on Sprouts, a David and Goliath story about Patty Amino, a woman who returned home to Apollo, Pennsylvania in 1988, only to discover that her town was engulfed in nuclear exposure from the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, or NUMEC. This interview with Libby Hallevi of Nuclear Hot Seat is the story of Patty's decades-long battle with NUMEC and the multi-million-dollar settlements that followed. Here's Libby Hallevi.
Patricia, better known as Patty Amino, is something of a legend for her work to force accountability and community compensation for radioactive contamination by the nuclear fuel processing facility across the street from where she grew up in Apollo, Pennsylvania. Patty passed away on May 10, 2024, after a lifetime fighting for justice and against multiple cancers. but she leaves behind a legacy of effective activism, the very model of the power of a single individual. And she also leaves behind this interview, which was recorded on January 20th, 2016. Patty Amino, welcome.
Glad to be here, Libby.
Where did you grow up and what was the area like?
Apollo, Pennsylvania. It was basically a really small town of about a little over 1,800 people, maybe 2,000 back then. And it was made up of blue-collar families that either worked in steel mills or in the mines or in the foundries. It was just the 50s and the 60s. Those were really big days of innocence. And Apollo, it abuts other towns and across the river from other towns in very close proximity. And so they're one of the hubs within the Kiske Valley. And the Kiske Valley is comprised of 13 communities. And you grew up here, you knew everybody in those 13 towns around.
When did you become aware of NUMEC, which stands for Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation? And how close to their facility did you live?
I grew up directly across the street from the plant, unknowingly across the street from a nuclear plant, and because it was an abandoned steel mill. And back in the day when I was, you know, coming up as a child, NUMEC got in there in 1957. And all we heard that it was an industry that was making fuel for Navy ships. The word nuclear, radiation, or atomic never came into, you know, the purview.
So the entire time you were growing up, you had no awareness that you had a nuclear facility next door. Did you have any sense of what they were doing with their waste material, or you just kind of played innocently throughout the area?
The kids would do what kids would do. I left the area at the age of 17, and I came back after I graduated from high school, and I came back intermittently. I went into the Navy, and I served for over 10 years, and I worked with Naval Investigative Service, which used to be called NIS. It's now fondly referred to as NCIS. And I got out on a disability, and I came back to the area. I went up to Indiana, Pennsylvania, and I used my GI Bill, and I furthered my education. And then I got picked up by the Defense Department as a federal criminal investigator. And so I was assigned in different parts of the United States, the last place being Southern California.
What brought you back to that area? And when did you start becoming aware that there was a problem with the NUMEC facility or what was left of it?
When I really first became aware of it was maybe just a couple days after I got home in December of 88. My dad started getting ill, and then I wasn't feeling all that great. And he said, Patty, he said, look, you retired out from the government. He says, you do investigations. Could you find out for me and for some of the other people in the town what's going on over at the plant? I said, what do you mean what's going on over at the plant? And he said, well, that's a nuclear plant. And that was the first time I ever heard the word nuclear referred to that site. I said, really? And he said, yes. He said, and the company isn't telling us anything. And I says, well, Dad, a company's not going to tell you anything. They're going to protect their own liability. And he said, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission isn't telling us anything either. And again, I was so naive coming out of the government thinking that that was just a communication breakdown. He said, that place had a lot of stacks. And some people were saying that maybe it came one off site. My dad retired out from the steel mill directly across the street, less than 100 feet is where I grew up and where the deli that was attached to the house was located. And so a lot of those workers would go into the deli with their work clothes on. And my dad wanted to know, and he had every right to know, and so did everybody else in the town.
In other words, if there was any residue perhaps on their clothing that they may have been depositing in the store or in your local area?
No, because of the stacks, 124 stacks. When I started getting the documents, I was jaw-dropped at the amount of stacks that that plant had.
Let's roll this back to how you began your investigation. of the site now that it's 1988 and your dad has made you aware that there may be some problems there?
After my dad made me promise to look into this, I found out that the plant was undergoing a decommissioning and that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had put documents, considered it a public document room, in the town library. So I would go up there, and these documents were on microfiche, and they had one of these old dinosaur viewers. Fortunately, this viewer had a printer on it as well. And those documents really tweaked my interest. The very first document I ever read was a 1957 document, and it was pre-startup report that the company had an outside contractor to do. And this contractor went out and around the town and took sampling so that they would have a baseline of what the radiation levels were prior to this plant starting up. And on page 4, there was just a 2-sentence paragraph. And the contractors were telling the company and highly recommended that the plant carry on with regular testing in the unrestricted areas for the future potential of any changes in state and federal laws and regulations, and for the potential of litigation. That was a very big flag to me.
It sounds like they were anticipating that there would be radiation or other forms of toxicity released, and that there would be lawsuits down the road. Is that what you got from this 2-sentence paragraph?
Absolutely, that they were dealing with something that would cause them a problem, and more than that, that would cause a problem for the people in the community.
Having gained this information, how did you proceed?
Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was having what they called exit meetings, and the company would be there. A couple times I wanted to ask the company managers some questions, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would not allow the company to answer questions, and I thought this very odd. It really appeared that they were shielding. They were the buffer. It didn't sit well. And then I noticed that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, when anybody in the community would ask about different levels of radiation that they would find or what type of testing they were doing inside of the plant, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they would come back, and the level of communication that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was bringing forth to the general public was intimidating. They were speaking about their formulas. They would mix rotogens with Becquerels, with picocuries per gram. They would mix this all up. And the people of this area are working class. And so they didn't know what they were speaking about. And the NRC did that on purpose.
When you saw that there was this kind of a blockade to the information, with you being a trained researcher, investigator, what did you do to start tracking down the truth?
My brother-in-law worked at that plant. And those guys were threatened with prison if they would have said anything about anything regarding what they did at that facility. He wouldn't talk to me. And so I started getting more documents. Some of the people were coming to me because they knew I was retired out from the government, and I would go to these meetings. But then I had some people coming to me and telling me that their dog, 5 years old, dying of cancer. And I noticed one day, just driving around, there were 2 people walking their dogs at different locations in the town, and they both had visible tumors all over these dogs. And so I went around to some of the vets and just asked them if they had noticed any incidents or increases in cancers in the dogs and the cats and any other animals. And they said it was very striking increase in cancers in these animals. From there, I went to the funeral homes, and I asked the funeral home directors about how many cancers they were seeing. Was there a significant amount of cancers? And they concurred there was a significant amount of cancers, and cancers in children. And that made me take a foot. I went around door to door. And in one community, Oklahoma, 200 feet from Apollo, there was a street up over the hill that had 16 homes. There were 8 homes in a row that all the women had breast cancer.
Wow.
Yeah, that was very striking to me. It was worse. And that was just the Apollo area. I went down to the Parks Township area where he had the plutonium facility. Here's this plutonium facility, and it abutted a dairy farm. I constantly was thinking, does this milk do a body good? I remember being able to see years ago the dairy cattle sitting out there, because I would ride with my dad out of Apollo into Leechburg. And I just, you know, remember those dairy cattle and not paying attention to what the other buildings were there. You just didn't know. And nobody suspected, because there wasn't a fence around that facility. There weren't placards. There were no cautionary signs, nothing that nobody would ever talk about, any warning.
Once you were collecting this information, what actions did you start taking on it?
I kept asking to have some off-site testing.
Who were you asking?
I asked the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at some of the exit meetings if they could please do some off-site testing to allay any fears, concerns, or questions that the general public would have concerning any possible emissions from that plant that may have escaped that plant. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, joined with the manager of the company, continuously stated that everything was perfectly safe and nothing went over the fence. And it was at that meeting that a woman by the name of Fran Munko stood up, just a housewife, Fran, stood up and asked the NRC manager at the time, it was a gentleman by the name of Jerome Roth, didn't you do some testing off-site? We saw you down at the riverbank. Could you tell us, did you find any contamination? And he is just giving her a bunch of over-highly technical gobbledygook. Mm-hmm. And so I saw Fran just kind of wilt down in her seat. But then she got back up again and she said, excuse me, I didn't understand what you said. Could you just answer the question, yes or no? Did you find any contamination off-site? And then my trigger got pulled, because that NRC official told her to sit down and shut up, that she had already had her question. That was all she wrote for me. Any civil decorum that I had, it left the door. And from the back of the hall, I said, you cannot talk to these people this way. You're a public servant. These people have questions, and you're required to give them the answers. And, you know, they basically closed a meeting up at that particular point, and I left out of there appalled at the way that the people have just been dismissed with their concerns. Whatever I can do, whatever resources I have, whether it's support, whether it's documents, whatever it is, I'm going to try to help them, because those are my brothers and sisters.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. I'm Stephanie Schubert with Pacifica Network, bringing you a program from Libby Halevi, producer and host of Nuclear Hot Seat. Her interview is with the late Patty Amino, an activist who fought for the truth about contamination from the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, or NUMEC, and the severe health problems it was causing people in her town of Apollo, Pennsylvania. When we left off the story, Patty was describing a town meeting where the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was refusing to answer questions from the public.
What I started doing after that was to raise the public awareness. I knew that the company had the workers feared about ever talking, and that the public was so trusting of our government. And so I was going out, was wearing sandwich board signs on my torso and carrying one in each hand, saying, honk if you want to be safe. and DEP protect the people, not the industry. And I was asking for an investigation. And it meant asking as an investigator what we know of is called the peak attention questions. For the most part, with the documents that I would have, I already had the answers. I wanted to hear what they said in public.
And what were they saying in public?
They were evasive. They wouldn't answer. They would continue on with the spiel that everything is perfectly safe. Then I went to a council meeting in Apollo and tried to get the fathers of the town to try to mandate or request the state to do off-site testing. Now, at this time, I was already diagnosed with one of my brain tumors. And there were a lot of incidents of brain tumors in that small town. And so I asked them, I said, look, we are a government that is based on a check and balance system. I understand and sympathize with the company's right to withhold any information. However, a lot of people in this town, including myself, is somewhat skeptical of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So could we then ask, as a governing body, for the EPA to come in and do some tests as a check and balance system? The manager of that plant was there. His name was Joe Sapega. He attempted to intimidate me. He came to me and he said, Miss Amino, if you would like to pay for all the cleanup costs and the delays that would occur therefrom, then go ahead. Well, the council took a break for an executive session on this issue. And Joe Sapega called me out into the hallway and he said, look, we haven't been formally introduced. I think I came off on some bad footing. My name is Joe Sapega, and I'm the manager of the plant. And I said, yes, I know. He said, we did a lot of business at your mom and dad's deli over there. I said, well, they appreciate it, and you got your money's worth. You didn't bring me out here to talk about my mom and dad's deli. What is it that you wish to speak about? And then he went on to tell me that what I was doing was not healthy for me. And I looked at him. I said, what the hell did you just tell me? He said, what you're doing is not healthy for you. And then the council came out of the office, and then Mr. Sapega turned and said, well, the document you want, it should be up in the public document room. And that was more fuel on my fire. I don't get intimidated. It just makes me angry.
And we're up to what year here?
1992.
So you got an area where there is a peak of cancer showing up in children, breast cancer in women, tumors in dogs, additional cancers showing up through the mortuaries and the people who had died. You've got all of this evidence that you are accumulating. Give us a sense of how the years went by while you were working at it, because we're only up to 1992 at this point.
Well, let me take you then to 1993. I had been working with Congressman John B. Murtha, and I got tired and I asked him, because when you go to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and ask a question, they would pawn it off and say, that's not our jurisdiction. That's the State Department of Environmental Protection's jurisdiction. Go to the state. They would come back with this. That's not our jurisdiction. That's the EPA's. I'm not going to chase my tail. So I went to Congressman Murtha and I said, we need a meeting to have a representative from all these agencies here so they can't continuously pass the buck. And that's exactly what happened. 6 months down the road, Congressman Murtha got us that meeting. And that meeting was advertised in the paper for 3 days to have time limitations. Now, under Robert's rules of order, that's about 3 to 5 minutes. You give me 3 to 5 minutes, I'm going to do some damage. But when we got into the meeting, you signed, as always, signed in. Then they asked us to take a number. And I said, what are you doing here? You give a raffle away at an environmental meeting? And they said, no. When your number's called, you get one question and one question only. I was off the hook. That was it. They did an unannounced, unadvertised changeup that was completely out of line. And then I noticed that there was police in the meeting. Never before had they had police at the meeting. An hour and a half before that meeting, I had a phone call from the company's, Babcock & Wilcox's attorney. He said, I understand you have some documents. And I said, I do. He said, would you be interested in meeting with me so we can go over those documents and so we can negotiate through them? He said the key word, negotiate. And so I told him, I said, you really want to know about these documents? He says, yes, I do, I do. I said, I suggest you pick the paper up tomorrow morning. Thank you very much. Click. An hour and a half later, I get to the meeting. Police is there. They changed it up. I ended up getting arrested for asking too many questions at a public meeting. 9 months later, I was acquitted. And then I turned around and sued the town because they ended up getting the town to facilitate it. The company did. And so did the NRC. And so I knew that it was just a matter of time because a couple months before that, my brake lines had been cut, all four of them.
On your car?
On my car. I could never say with definite who did it, but I had never had any problems before. In November of 1993, I spoke to Bill Silkwood, as in Karen Silkwood's father, because I knew at that particular point, after that arrest, they were going to keep coming after me. They had the police following me and stopping me, checking my registration, checking my insurance and everything. You know, I had a hard way to go because the community was behind the government at the time. So I called Bill Silkwood. I told him what my plight was. He said, you need to talk to an attorney. I says, well, could you tell me who it was that was representing Karen that she was due to meet? And he said, that's Steve Walker. He had changed his name because he didn't want the notoriety in the movie. He gave me Steve's number. I called Steve up. He was familiar with Newmec. He said, do you have any documents? I said, yeah, how many do you want? He said, how many do you have? I said, thousands at this point. And he says, well, just give me some of the most demonstrative evidence. I said, okay. I said, do you want any videotape? He started laughing. He said, you got videotape too? I said, yeah, I videotaped. He said, send it on. I sent it overnight express. He was in my living room 3 days later. On June the 6th, 1994, that first federal civil action was filed.
So you filed your first federal action against Babcock & Wilcox and Atlantic Richfield Corporation in 1994. How far did that get and what did you have to do to follow up on it?
Well, that case took 14 years. However, Fred Barron, who was the lead attorney, when it came to trial in 1998, of 200 people who were on, there was 8 people who were the first test plaintiffs. That the case, when it went to trial, of the first 8 test plaintiffs, the jury awarded those people $37.6 million. And the most important thing out of a federal civil action is discovery, because there came the mother load of documents right there that had never seen the light of day before. They were released to my attorney, and my attorney gave them all to me as well.
And this is the same attorney as was Karen Silkwood's attorney.
He was one of Karen Silkwood's attorneys, yes. And thank God I was able to get probably the best environmental attorneys in the country, Steve Waka, the late Fred Barron, and his team, oh my goodness, Kay Reeves, Alicia Butler, Michael Kasky, who's down in Texas.
Incredible. So with this first finding, was there any kind of resolution for the case, or did this just open up additional channels?
That case was finally settled in two parts. 2007, Atlantic Richfield bailed on Babcock & Wilcox, and they settled. And Babcock & Wilcox finally settled in 2009. The overall settlements were approximately $92 million.
Who was it who received that $92 million?
People in the community who had either buried their children, buried their husbands or wives, or who had cancers that were survivors.
Patty, we wish you every health, every blessing, and truly, you are an example of what a single, motivated, focused individual can do. When we can come together with you and with people like you all over, we can succeed, and you are a living example of that.
Thank you, Libby. And I'll tell you what you do is an enormous resource for people. And I thank you very, very much.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to nuclear activist Patty Amino's battle with Newmec the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation. Patty Amino pursued multiple lawsuits with NUMIC before her passing in 2024. You can hear her full story at nuclearhotseat.com. Our contributor this week was Libby Halevi, producer and host of Nuclear Hot Seat. Editing assistance from Stephanie Schubert. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase globally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Stephanie Schubert with Pacifica Network. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.